Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Honored to have you here. On today's show, I interview Master of Wine, Vanessa Conlin. She's a good friend. She is all over the SOM TV network. She's in a wine tasting session. She does some wine and food pairing things for Delicacy. She has a ton coming up, including a travel show that we are working on. I'm very, very, very excited about that. We're talking about the Master of Wine certification, what it means, what her path was going through it, and how it compares to the Master Sommelier certification. Vanessa was a classically trained opera singer and decided to pivot with her career into wine. And it's kind of a remarkable story. She's also the host of an incredible wine auction that's outside of the paywall on SOM TV this weekend on this Saturday, July 25th. It is called the Wine-a-Palooza Wine Auction, and it has some of the most insane experiences and bottles that you can find anywhere in the world. You know, 3 liters of Screaming Eagle and experiences with NBA players and just wild, wild stuff. And it all goes to benefit an incredible organization that helps provide support for animals all over the Bay Area of the United States. You know, they've dealt with fires and all sorts of things. This organization helps save horses and cats and dogs. And it's just really one of the premier organizations in the world. But besides that, their annual fundraiser is world-renowned for the wines and the experiences that happen. So Vanessa's hosting that, and that is not behind a paywall on SOM TV. So everybody should tune in this Saturday at 5 p.m. Pacific time and watch this. It's amazing. I want to remind everybody that our merchandise is up. Everything from baby bibs that say Future SOM to coffee mugs and, you know, all the stuff that sort of will remind people of how much you love wine is up there. It is shop.somtv.com. Our blind tasting card game, Blinders, is available and shipping right now. It is at blindersgame.com. We are about to, and probably with the, it might be available right now. We're about to drop our coming soon sizzle reel for SOM TV. All the new stuff coming, which has all sorts of people, David Chang and Andrew Zimmern and our entire new cast, and a first look at the next SOM movie. I cannot wait for you guys to see the next SOM film. It is called The Cup of Salvation. We have filmed all over the Middle East and all over the Caucasus Mountains. It's something very special, so I look forward to that. Without further ado, my conversation with Vanessa Conlin. Vanessa, how are you?
Jason, I have a glass of champagne, I have a cup of coffee and some sparkling water, so I'm doing well. Plus, I'm here with you. I always love the chance to talk with you, so I couldn't be better.
I love it. It's basically, you know, it's coffee to come up, it's alcohol to calm down, and then you just rinse and repeat.
It works for me.
It's good. It's really good. All right, so first, you're hosting this event, and really fast, I think you should talk to people about the concept of a wine auction, because this Wine-a-Palooza thing that's airing on SOM TV is pretty special. But how does it fit in with the wine auction concept?
So there's so many special things about the wine business that I'm proud to be a part of. But one is that we actually do so much good as an industry for lots of people. And one way we do that is through what we call charity wine auctions. So something like Naples Winter Wine Festival or Auction Napa Valley, Premier Napa Valley, you know, that benefits all sorts of different organizations in those communities. Wine-a-Palooza is the wine charity auction for the Jameson Animal Rescue Ranch, which is based here in Napa Valley but benefits the Bay Area and is really intended to be sort of a model for around the country for not just animal wellness but human and environmental. So basically, this is an annual fundraiser. We have amazing donation and participation from the vintners in Napa Valley who are so generous. You know, people like Andy Beckstoffer, Philippe Melka, Helen Keplinger. I mean, the roster, it's kind of amazing who's who of Napa.
I mean, the wines that you guys are going to be auctioning off, I mean, it's lots of like Screaming Eagle. It's lots of like,
oh yeah,
just insanity.
I mean, we have a lot donated by Jeannie Phillips, founder of Screaming Eagle, from her cellar, 3 3-liters of Screaming Eagle, 96, 97, 98. I mean, these things, like, you just can't find them other places. But the best part is not only can you bid on and hopefully win these amazing auction lots, but it all benefits the animals, the humans, and the environment.
Can I ask you an honest question?
Of course.
Do you have, like, did Jeannie kill somebody and you have info on that? Like, how did you get, how did you do that? I mean, how do you get three large format bottles of Screaming Eagle that have age on them at all? How is that even humanly possible?
Two main reasons. First is, you know, Monica and David Stevens, owners of 750 Wines here in Napa Valley, they are so beloved by this community. They've launched so many brands and supported so many vintners in this community that they just have an incredible, loyal following. The other thing is, honestly, we call it JAR for short, Jameson Animal Rescue Ranch. They've really shown their impact on this community, you know, during things like the fires in 2017, in terms of responsiveness, helping people, not just animals, but the humans in this community that people just are dying to help.
It's pretty remarkable. I was at the event last year, and I put up, there was an auction lot that involved me, you know, a drinking experience type thing, and it got bought by the New Orleans Pelicans. So it was, I'm very much looking forward to fulfilling that because I think I actually won that more than they did.
I think that's where I met you for the first time, actually.
That's probably right.
Was that Wendapalooza? Which
behaving myself.
Well, I'm surprised either of us remembers because there's always so much wine flowing at that event. It's usually kind of the most epic event of the year.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Well, we're thrilled to have it on SOM TV. I mean, it's really an honor.
Thank you. I mean, look, I can't thank you enough. We can't thank you. You know, we didn't know what to do this year, obviously, with COVID and not being able to gather and not being able to travel, but we really wanted to still be able to have this amazing fundraiser. And so courtesy of SOM TV and you and Christina and your whole team were able to bring the Napa Valley out into, you know, anyone's living rooms or smartphones or wherever they are in the world that want to watch.
Yeah, so here's how you watch. Any of our listeners, you have no excuse not to tune in because it's not behind the paywall. So you go to somtv.com or you just download the app on any device, you know, your smart TV, your iPad, your Apple TV, your Amazon Fire, your Roku, and you tune in that way. And there's live bidding, but there's also ways to get tickets. Vanessa, how do you get tickets for the...
So you can go to winepalooza.com. As you said, you can register for free to watch on SOM
TV. That's Pawlooza like a paw, right?
Yes, wine up Pawlooza. So you can register there. And if you choose to, you can also buy a package, which involves having wine shipped to you so that you can sort of be drinking along with the selections.
Fun. I will be drinking along even though I'll be filming it. So I look forward
to it. And I will be drinking along even though I'm being filmed.
Oh, I can't wait for this. I don't know if you've ever done a live show like this, but this is going to be intense. I look forward to it. So this Saturday, you're in for it.
All right. I'm ready. I love a challenge.
All right. Okay. 5 p.m. Pacific time. Tune in. All right. So one of the main things I want to talk to you about, I mean, obviously, I would assume the audience listening to this is familiar with the SOM movies and SOM TV and all the other stuff that I have been a part of. But you're an MW. You're a master of wine. So I think the point of reference for a lot of people, and this might be my fault, or at least I've you know, might be partially my fault, is they think of the, you know, master sommelier. I want to talk to you about what the difference is and does it get confused for you and what it means and what the test is like.
Yeah, I think you did an amazing service to the world of wine by opening up people's eyes to understanding what these credentials are, these certifications. So, you know, look, kudos to you. Do they get confused? 100%. But I would say, if anything...
I have more than a few MWs who would be less polite than you just were to me, but I'll take it.
Well, look, in the end, I would say maybe it's the fault of the MW, you know, organization for not kind of putting themselves out there more and making themselves more visible. So I don't think that, I mean, you did everything right. And I think it was great the way that you highlighted kind of what dedication it takes, you know, whether you're pursuing the master sommelier or the master of wine, and kind of how a little bit, you know, OCD and you have to be and willing to drive your family crazy and possibly go bankrupt.
A little bit.
but yeah, at least a little bit, but I'm being polite. But no, for sure, I'd say, you know, I'd say nine people out of 10 that I talk to, even when I, you know, I say, no, I'm not a master sommelier, I'm a master of wine, they'll revert right back to like, oh, well, I watched the movies. Like, was that true? And I'll say, I think so. But that's, again, I'm actually not an MS. I'm an MW. So there does seem to be a fair amount of confusion. But, you know, I'd say, look, they're both sort of the highest credentials you can get in the wine industry. The master of wine is different in a number of ways. Our exam is written, whereas the master sommelier, it's all, you know, spoken. Ours is sort of based on more an understanding of all consumer levels. So that includes, you know, entry-level grocery-stacked wines all the way up to, you know, class growth Bordeaux, you know, first growth Bordeaux. And the reason I say that is because, you know, the master sommelier is so great in what it does, but I'd say most consumers of wine in the world probably don't.
You're very political. You're very political with your answers. Okay.
Well, don't know what a sommelier is, have never spoken to one. You know, it's this, the MS program is so geared and focused and perfect for working a restaurant floor and selling wines tableside and really understanding producers at that level where a restaurant would have the budget for a sommelier. But, you know, I mean, if you look at the majority of wine consumers, you know, a premium wine is considered $9. So I'd say, you know, for the MW, you're expected to know, stylistically, every wine in the world is testable. There's nothing off limits. It's not, you know, only classic wines, it's anything. And it's any price, any quality level has to be understood.
Because on the Master Somm exam, there's this classic, things have to be classic. Is it the same? Like, it has to have typicity from a place and be a Shiraz from Australia that's a typical Shiraz, or a Malbec from Argentina that's typical, or
right. No,
could you get a Yellowtail Chardonnay?
Oh, 100%. Behringer White Zin has been on the exam. Yellowtail's been on the exam. So has Dom Perignon, you know, and Solos.
Wow.
So it's really understanding, just having a real understanding.
I kind of find that more useful. I mean, you know, that. I have no allegiance. I have literally, despite what people may think, I have nothing to do with the Master Somm exam. I, you know, good people all around, but. You know, maybe not all around, but, you know, good people. And
yeah.
But I think there's way more use in having that full gamut because it is actually practical.
Well, and I think what I appreciate about the MW program, or why I chose it, was really you have to use critical thinking. So I'm not a memorize a flashcard type person. Like, I have to have context to really remember things. And so for the MW, it's never just to like name these, you know, crews of whatever. It's going to be, you know, asking a question where you have to tie your knowledge into, you know, maybe viticulture, vinification, marketing, you know, laws, and then form an argument and defend it and show that you understand both sides of the argument. Almost like you're, you know, in a court of law and you're having to like defend someone and also argue their case. So it's like you have to just show that you're not forming one. In the end, you have to decide what you're going to back up, but you have to show that you understand every angle, and do that in a written format. So
you guys do blind tasting, but you write the answers.
We do. So we taste 36 wines blind, but everything is written.
Oh,
so every wine is weighted 25 points. And that's all, again, backed up with written arguments. And so it's very much about accuracy, but it's also about showing your work and your logic. So there's a whole strategy in terms of, you know, how you form your answer. Like, we call it a banker. Like, I know exactly what this wine is. I'm going to go for the jugular, but I still have to explain every single reason why I know exactly that this is Hunter Valley Semillon. You know, if I just said it's Hunter Valley Semillon, I'd get, you know, 2 points out of 25 and I would fail that question. So you still have to prove it. And then it's the same, like, you know, we call them laterals. So let's say I'll use Gruner Veltliner and Albarino as an example where that's, you know, often people confuse those. So maybe you get that wine on the exam and you're like, I'm not exactly sure which it is, but I'm going to show that I'm a good taster, that I understand why it could be either of these. And in the end, I have to choose one. But I can pick up points along the way showing that I know how they're similar and in the end how they're different. And then there's a whole, like, holy shit, I have no idea what this wine is, but I still have to show that I understand how to taste wine and what the style is. In the end, I'm going to take my best guess knowing what this could be in the world of wine.
So you have to do 36 wines. Is that in one day or is that over the course of days?
So the we call it the practical exam, 36 wines over 3 days. So we do day one, we call them papers. So paper one is all white wines, 12 wines, all white. Paper two, all reds. And paper three is... could be anything. White, red, rosé, sparkling, fortified, sweet. We don't taste beer. We don't taste sake. We don't taste spirits. But other than that, anything at all is completely up for grabs.
That's incredible. I mean, so you can get a, you know, Oloroso sherry and a rosé in the same
Same paper. And then there's a whole strategy too. Paper three is like, you have to like, what do I taste first? Because you want to blow your palate out with a sweet wine. And then you're like, oh shit, now like wine 12 is a dry rosé. And I just tasted a bunch of, you know, ports and Madeiras. And so there's a lot of strategy. And then the theory portion is spread over 4 days. And we also call this papers. So five different written papers. On things, you know, starting with vinification all the way up to, viticulture all the way up through current events.
So it's like a month-long test.
Basically. Yeah. Just give them a month.
Do they give you the results? Because I know that's like, you know, it infuriated people with my first film. And it's like, it's not my fault. I didn't determine that they don't tell you the exam results. Does the MW say?
So they do publish after the exam is over what the wines were. So you can go back and reference in your own head, like, what did I call them versus what they were? But you never actually get your exam back, which is also—
Okay, so it's not like redlined with like B minus or anything? Okay.
No, if you don't pass, you get a grade. You actually do get a grade. But if you pass, you never get a grade. You never get to see your paper. So, and I think the reason for that, they don't want someone to be, oh, you're more a master of wine than this other master of wine, right? Like, either you pass
or you don't. No offense to you here, Vanessa, but I know your type. You guys would do that. I could see that happening. I mean—
I hope not, but I could see that.
having had the pleasure of getting to know Jancis Robinson, I could see her going, I'm just slightly more of a master of wine than you are.
I have to tell you that this whole thing about like, when they published the what the wines were a couple days later, I remember my friend Mary Margaret, who was already an MW when I sat the exam, she was like, the minute you walk out of the room, write down what you called because you're going to forget. Like, I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, come on. Literally, you go into this like complete like brain fog where I'm like, I literally with a gun to my head could not tell you what I called wine two. And that's what happened like the first, because I did not pass practical the first year. I passed theory on my first attempt and practical on my second. So after the first year, I went back and I was like, I literally have no recollection of what I called. So the next year, the second the exam was over, I like walked outside the room. I wrote down everything that I thought it was so that when the results were published, I could at least compare and have, you know, you don't know whether you've passed or failed, but you're like, okay, I have a fighting chance based on what these wines were.
Love it. What's the point of doing this? I mean, when you talk about the MW exam and what you went through, and obviously I can only assess that it was probably at the same level of pressure and exhaustion and expense as what the other exams people are familiar with.
Yeah.
Why do this?
I mean, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I have a background in music. So I was a professional classical singer and, you know, I spent a lot of time, like every day you basically wake up and you're like, I need to better myself. I need to practice. I need to, you know, get better at my craft. And so I kind of already had that mindset where it's also not competitive with anyone else. You're just being competitive with yourself. Because, you know, there's no quota. There's no limit on how many people can pass. It's just how you do. So I kind of had that instinct already. But, you know, honestly, like I was working in the wine industry. I was working out here at a winery in Napa Valley. And I felt like, you know, I'd already been a buyer in New York City for three businesses. I knew a good amount about wine, but I'd hear the winemaker, let's say, start talking about something like, you know, pH. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And that drives me bonkers. And so I just wanted to really understand and be part of these conversations about wine because it's my total passion. You know, it's my obsession in life is understanding wine, but getting other people excited about it. So for me, it was just kind of a personal challenge that I wanted to pass.
Well, and I can also imagine your dating life just goes crazy when you can talk about German must-weight levels.
Oh, I mean, total magnet. Total. I mean, yeah.
I'm such a shit. I'm just kidding. No, I think it's extraordinary. I think that this exam, I mean, it's easy for me to armchair film and talk about these things, but putting yourself through this is pretty remarkable. It is no joke.
Thank you. Well, I have to tell you, Jason, we do joke on the MW side that, gosh, we wish he had a film like Psalm, but it would be so boring because you just film a silent room of people writing for 3 hours. So I think you made the right choice. If you need validation, you just got it.
I think the last thing anybody wants is for me to have validation on Psalm.
But one thing I just want to add about the MW, which I really appreciate that I don't know that people understand completely, is that when we take the exam, we're also anonymous. So we're just a number on a piece of paper that gets sent off to, sent off to London.
Oh, interesting. So you're not actually in front of people when they examine you.
I mean, there are obviously proctors in the room, MWs, who are, of course, minding that everyone is keeping their eyes on their own paper. But no, I mean, nobody knows whether you're male or female, your age, what you're wearing that day, where you're from, how many times you set the exam. It really is just based on your knowledge that day. So I really appreciate that about the MW.
Can I ask a question that you may not want? Did you feel, as a woman, were you nervous from that position or anything? I mean, I think there's a lot of people in the entire wine world that feel or have felt like they're not the same kind of opportunities. Did you feel that at all in the MW or no?
I really didn't. And I have to say, I had so many female mentors in the program. I mean, Mary Ewing Mulligan, back from my New York days.
You're also a kick-ass person. I don't expect you to have but I'm just curious from a standpoint of the wine business needs to reflect the real world. And I don't have a lot of familiarity with
the wine business absolutely does in so many ways. So not making light of that in any way, but I did say, going in, I felt knowing that I was just a number in the end on my exam, I didn't feel that I had a better or a lesser chance than anyone else in the room. But I would like to help more people feel like they have a place in the room.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, it's and also, I'm sure there's quite a bit more work than just saying that. I can only imagine.
Oh, we're just scratching the surface. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know. And that could be another 27 podcasts that, frankly, as a white male, probably not my place to have. So when it comes to wines as something that keeps you, I say this often on these podcasts that I'm really interested in the people that have done this for a while and reached high levels and keep working and don't become jaded. I mean, you are the least jaded person. honestly, you are so go with the flow, so positive.
Thank you.
And it's pretty easy in this business. I mean, at least you could admit it's easy to become jaded. I mean, there are some people. So what is it that keeps you excited about this every day and keeps you pushing? Is it individual regions or wine or new regions, or you just like it?
I think I really like, I've just always enjoyed that moment where you see somebody's eyes light up like they really understand something. So for me, it's always been sort of like sharing that excitement with people, getting people excited about wine. And I have to relate it a little bit back to my music, if you can just indulge me for, 30 seconds. But, I grew up in a family of classical musicians. I always thought I was going to be a musician. It would often be this sort of, dinner side debate or conversation we'd have, because classical music was totally, I mean, I love all music. Like Led Zeppelin is my jam.
What did you sing? Yep. Really fast, well, just for context. I mean, were you singing like George Bizet or like,
yeah,
like I, Verdi or what?
Opera. So, it was, Puccini, Bizet, lots of Mozart. But again, I love all kinds of wine. I love jazz. I love classic rock. So, but it's kind of it's an art form that people find very intimidating and feel that there's a high barrier to entry. And so it would be this conversation that we'd have, over the dinner table, like, how do we make people understand this is really meant for the people? This was an art form that was meant for the people, but it became this sort of like just unattainable sort of elitist, form. And so I've kind of taken that to wine, where I'm like, there does seem to be this high barrier barrier of entry for a lot of people where they feel like they have to know something. And these names aren't very easily pronounced. And, you know, so how do you kind of take your excitement for it and make it relatable in a way that people can understand?
Well, hold on, though. Going back to music, I mean, yeah. There are certain, you know, classical music as a whole, I mean, it's tough to put ourselves in the, you know, the 1700s in Vienna, but
right.
A lot of it wasn't, I mean, not all of it was for the people. I mean, Mozart's Magic Flute was for the people, but I mean, there's plenty of operas that were not
for
the average person.
Oh, sure, sure. No, I mean, you're definitely right.
And wines like that too is why I'm coming into that, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, there were definitely operas that were commissioned for the emperor, you know, but then there were also, you know, operas for the people where they'd be eating and drinking and having conversations during it, and it was a social occasion, and, you know, people would be walking down the street whistling these tunes that it was kind of meant for everyone. It was meant to be inclusive. So you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there are wines that I can't ever afford, right? Unless it's on someone else's dime, and I'm an MW, and I'm still not going to be able to drink them. But you know, there are plenty of wines that are made to be inclusive. So that's if that answers your question, that's kind of what gets me excited. But if I can use one more example, if you'll indulge me for 30 more seconds, but
I have a glass of wine. I'm in.
Okay. Well, so I am. You know, I was used to performing on and different, you know, opera stages, and that involves a lot of, you know, traveling nationally and internationally. But I did have an opportunity to do a show on Broadway, which was Baz Luhrmann, the movie director of, you know, Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes.
Strictly Ballroom.
Oh, Strictly Ballroom. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes. How could I forget? that's such a great movie, by the way. I love that.
It's really good. I would say it's his. Well, my favorite of his films.
Now I have to go back and watch that. That's so great. But so he produced a Broadway version of Puccini's La Bohème. And it was updated in terms of time period, but we performed it, you know, full length, no cuts, in Italian on Broadway. And we were nominated for Tony Award. And I wasn't the star of the show. I was just in the ensemble. But it was so cool for me to see, like, these people who had never heard an actual orchestra before, you know, playing in the pit, and then we'd leave the stage door, and it was like groupies for this opera. And I was like, I've never seen anything like this before. And that's kind of how I feel about wine. Like, why can't everyone just get excited? And maybe it's your first experience and you think you're not going to like it, and maybe you decide it isn't for you. But just to see so many people's eyes open because we gave them an opportunity to experience something new, that's what I like.
Well, that's really well said. I mean, you know, but the key there is you have somebody like Baz Luhrmann, who's like kind of like a, you know, he's like a weird operatic rock star, yeah. Really theatrical kind of director. You know, I mean, all of his films, the camera doesn't stop moving ever. And like, you know, it's all this big stuff. So for him to do that, La Bohème is really accessible. So
yeah.
That's an interesting thing to put that as a, you know, as the analogy, because... And I think that's also when a lot of celebrities, I know you work with a lot of people in the NBA and things, when they get into wine, it does kind of the same effect. It makes people go, oh, you know, this particular thing is not so hard to understand because I like, you know, basketball and I didn't know it mixed with wine. And I don't know, maybe I'm off there, but it kind of feels similar.
No, I think it's true. I think that's an interesting discussion and one that I don't have the answer to, but because I do feel like with the NBA, you have some people who are drinking at a level that's so unattainable, you know, in terms of price point. But then you have people who are really promoting wines that are at all price points. And like someone who I really enjoy, and I know you've met him, is Josh Hart, you know, who plays on the Pelicans, who's just like the sweetest guy and like so intellectually curious about wine, so unafraid to admit what he doesn't know and ask questions, which I also really love, you know, because
he's like incredibly polite too. This
yeah.
guy is like, you know, I realize how old I am when I'm around these like young NBA players, which yep. is a weird sentence, but I realize how old I am because like, you know, he's just so polite. Like just the nicest guy. I mean,
he is.
Truly, Josh is a good guy.
Yeah, no, totally. And, And you know, just kind of brings people along with his excitement. So I love that. But, you know, I also love, you know, someone I spoke to recently too is Dwayne Wade. And, you know, he has his own wine and he's really trying to make wines of all price points to kind of, you know, bring people along this journey, whether they're going to be, you know, they have the MBA expense budget or, you know, they have their you know, a little smaller expense budget. But someone who's like super humble and excited about bringing people along this journey.
That's great. No, it's just fantastic. So, okay. So I want to do something with you because you work at Wine Access. You guys sell a ton of wine. Mm-hmm. A lot of wine goes through your fingers. A lot of wine goes through all this stuff. So the question I have for you is, if I'm trying to build a cellar and I want to do it on a little bit of a budget, okay? Mm-hmm. Do you think you could pull 5 wines out of your head that right now you can get are current or recent releases that are not too expensive that would last 20, 30 years in a cellar?
You know, I do. I mean, what I would look for—
I'm really putting you on the spot here, but it's one of the questions a lot of people ask is, what will age and what do I, you know, and obviously it has to be a wine you want to age, but does it have to be $175 a bottle? Can it be cheaper? Where does it come from? What does it mean? I mean, I'm just curious what you'd answer this question.
You know, I think you can. And of course, it goes back to like when everyone's definition of I want a mature bottle is different, right? So like, do you want to mature it for 20 years? Do you want to have 5 years on it? But I think so. I mean, I think what I'd look for is, you know, it seems like no one in the wine business, when they have sort of a second wine, they want to call it, they don't want to call it that. They're like, it's the baby brother. But there are, you know, these sort of projects from really prestigious properties like, you know, Colina from Dalla Valle, Basso from Donna Estates, you know, so some of these Quartet from Arrieta, where I think you can drink at a really, really high quality where you have people like, you know, Andy Erickson making these wines, Philippe Mocha, but it's not their top tier wine. So, and it's, you know, it's kind of the thing that like the Bordelais have been doing for years. Like they're not afraid to make a second wine, a third wine. In Napa, people are doing it. They don't know what to call it. So I think you can, but I think like ultimately, it's about, is it in balance, you know? And for me, if I'm looking at something that is age-worthy, it's usually not the wine that I'm going to open and go, oh my God, this is so in my face right now, right? It's probably one where I have to sit and ponder for a minute and wait for it to kind of unveil itself a little bit. But it's all about balance, you know?
So like what? So like, let's say that I, you know, I'm just trying to think of like, what are the wines somebody should take a look at if you're walking into building your very first cellar? I mean, I always steer people towards, you know, like, for example, certain German Rieslings and things mm-hmm. that could just go and go, which are, you know, they become more and more accessible. Some people just aren't into that wine. But what will age?
I mean, it's kind of producer dependent, you know, of course. But I mean, I always look for acid, tannin, fruit balance, you know, in a wine. I think like Riesling is such a great example. It's got, you know, that acid is like screaming. Sometimes you have residual sugar, you know, which also can act as a preservative. So it's things like that. It's good tannic structure. But I mean, I remember being at a lecture, I don't know, 10 years ago, something with Tor Kenward. And just to go back to this idea of balance, he's, you know, sometimes I think people will use this thing, well, it's out of balance now, but it's because it's young. And his thing was like, no, like a wine that's out of balance is always going to be out of balance. So to use your Riesling example, like I think a Riesling you can have, you know, you could have a super high acid, low alcohol wine, but everything matches itself. Like nothing seems, and the residual sugar will seem in context because of everything else. It doesn't seem overly sweet, even though it might have, you know, whatever, 40, 50 grams per liter. So I think it's really just about like if you're cooking, right? How do all of those ingredients work together? If they don't taste good right off the bat, they're probably not going to get better after it marinates.
No, I think that is a tremendous analogy. If you're going to take all of the ingredients and make beef bourguignon, in order for them to cook down and taste good together, they still should taste good together separate before they've melted together. Yeah,
right. Like they'll get better the next day, but if they suck on the day one, they're definitely not going to taste good on day two.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the big things I you know, the reason I asked the question is it's one of the big things I want to crack because obviously collecting wine is, you know, is this 1,000 tiers to that question mm-hmm. and the answer and then your taste change and, you know, the whole deal. And there's easy, expensive, big name brands and things like that. But there's no real way for people to start collecting wine. And it's one of the things that drives me nuts about Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't save wine at all. We just, there's just,
No.
They just don't save wine. And so one of my missions before I die is to figure out how do I get Americans to start just, you know, saving 50 bottles, you know, over the course of a year or 2 years or whatever. I mean, that's why I asked the question.
I guess I'd ask too, though, then like, is the point then so that we have a greater understanding of what happens to wine over time? Because I'd also say like...
No, it's so that when I come to your house, you have wine.
Oh, okay. Now,
no, I'm just kidding.
Now
no, just
I understand. Kidding. Now I understand.
No,
Jason.
No.
No, but I mean, you know, that's the other thing about consumers, right? Is not everyone wants mature wine. Like some people really want to drink wine that's fruity and primary and kind of like flashy and in your face. And I'd say that's okay. You know, that's fine too. But I'll say, you know, I used to live in New York City and I lived in a, you know, brownstone apartment, but you know, just one, it was like this when it used to be one house. I'm sure it was really cool, but then they chopped it up and made apartments. So basically, I had like a nice living room, and then my bedroom literally, my bed was in a loft, and my closet was underneath it. You know, I mean, I had like no space. My husband's a classical musician, so I had a grand piano that took up most of my living room. I had no room to collect. So, you know, I, as much as I loved wine, I was working in the wine business. I had like 5 bottles that I had in like the back of my closet next to my shoes because it was the furthest thing away from the radiator. And that was about as good as I could do at that point. So,
I mean, New York City, that's actually sounds like quite a place.
I don't know, Jason. It wasn't that grand. If I used the microwave and the toaster at the same time, I blew out the circuits for the entire building. So.
Oh my God. It's great. It's like a college dorm with a grand piano. I love this.
Basically.
No, that's good. Well, okay, so you know, let's at least end this with something you've drank that surprised you, or something you drank recently that you want to tell people about.
Well, I'll tell you what's in my glass right now, which is I'm really excited about. Which is I'm a bubblehead. I love champagne, but. I'll bring you a bottle next time I see you, but it's called Embrunyon.
You're going to see me in like two, you're going to see
I know.
Me, not maybe tomorrow. I don't even know. Is it tomorrow or the next day?
From a social distance with masks, of course. But yes, I get to see you
behave.
Very
yes, ma'am.
Soon for our virtual Wine-a-palooza, which I'm very excited about. So it's a champagne called Embrunyon. It's from Ecoy in Montagne de Rem. And I'm super excited about it because it's something that we actually direct import from Wine Access. And we sell it for $35. It's, you know, from a Premier Cru village. It's super high quality, but these people basically, Alain and Valerie, the owners, like show up on their doorstep. This is 2 years ago. Because I was asking around like, hey, what's like, who's a producer I should know about that doesn't have any representation in the United States? And these guys are like he's the president of the Growers Organization. They sell wine to like Krug and Dom, but just make their own little small production champagne. And I think they thought they were getting punked. Cause I was like, hey, can I import like a pallet or two of this? And also
$35 for really any wine of
right.
that kind of quality is outstanding, but for champagne, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Really and good. they were super cool because I tasted some wines and I love these, but they were a little bit higher on the dosage level for what I thought our consumers would like at Wine Access. It was more like around 8 grams. And so they did, or a little bit higher. And so they custom dosaged it for us, disgorged and dosaged it at 6 grams per liter. And this is like my total go-to. And I love to blind people on this because like for $35 it's like such a knockout.
This is great. Well, yeah, please. I need a couple bottles.
You got
next
it.
Time we see each other.
You know I got you. You and Christina.
I love it.
I got you.
I love it. Love it. Well, it's a pleasure talking. I hope honestly, I truly, truly want everybody listening to this. 5 p.m. on Saturday, get some alcohol, sit down and bid on these wine auctions. The stuff is insane. It's like experiences with NBA players, wines you literally could not, let alone see, you could never touch. I mean, it is just wild.
Oh, you're so
what is coming.
It's so true. And I think like what's really fun, and you know, this is all courtesy of your production there at SOM TV, but like the videos that you get to see, because most of this is pre-taped because, you know, we are in a little bit of a quarantine situation, but seeing these vintners kind of let their hair down and have some fun for the animals, you know, Tor, Andy, you know, Fritz Hatton, it's really
fun. And a lot of
fun.
Them actually have quite a bit of hair with the COVID situation. I was kind of amazed with these videos.
Well, what I was laughing really hard because there's a video with Patrice Bertrand from Vice Versa and Philippe Melka, and they're out in, you know, Tokalon Vineyard. And like, of course, Patrice has shaved his head completely. And then Philippe, like, I've never seen him, like, with his hair looking anything like he just, like, rolled out of bed or was, like, in a tornado. And it's just, it's so perfect because it's what I would expect from Philippe. But,
Yeah. No, it's a very good, like, French farmer look, too, you know, because yeah. He's from France.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay, so I want to get these details right because mm-hmm. I will be working camera and producing on set. So I want to get this right. You're going to be actually on – you're on camera.
I'm so you on have to, camera live, God help us all, with Fritz Hatton on
– Nah, you'll be Saturday. Great. It's going to be hilarious.
It'll be fun. It'll be a lot of fun. Yeah.
I will – you know, just as a viewer, you want to turn into live shows because, you know, something might go wrong. It'll be hilarious. It's good. We'll, yeah.
Well, luckily, Fritz and I have a really good rapport. He was actually the first boss I ever had at a winery. So I worked at Arrieta. I was their first non-production employee, and I actually worked out of their garage, which was not a converted garage. It was literally their garage.
That's great. Sounds like the place we made the first three Saw movies. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, but no, he's great. We go way back, so we have a really good rapport, and no, it'll be fun. It'll be fun. And so
it's going to be fantastic. It really is. It's going to be great. If there are any problems, I hope they're yours and not mine. That's all I'm asking for. No technical problems.
There's nothing we can't overcome because we will have champagne. So
that should be on our gravestones. I really like that. Okay, so Wynapalooza.
Mm-hmm. Wynapalooza.
July 25th. Mm-hmm. Wynapalooza, July 25th, 5 p.m. Pacific time.
5 p.m. streaming live on SOM TV.
And you can watch it. There are tickets and wine you can get and all sorts of stuff. Tell me the website again so I make sure it's just Wynapalooza.com.
Wynapalooza.com. Yep.
Okay. This is great. It's free. It's open. Whether you're a subscriber or not, you can watch. And it will definitely be really, really, really funny. I can tell you that because I've seen all of your skits and things. All right. Well, good stuff, Vanessa. Thanks for being on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Can't wait to see you
yourself.
Soon. I can't
we
promise
will see
that.
You very soon.
But I promise I'll see you soon.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We will talk very soon. Next week, I have Shakira Jones, who starts a new podcast called A Glass for Every Palate. This podcast is going to be fantastic. All right. See you then. Bye.